Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Fraser McAlpine.
I'm Laura Snapes.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Fine. I'm in a state of delirium, which I'm going to attribute to too much sun this weekend and also election excitement. How are you?
Exactly the same. It's been an insane week. Like, when we were recording the podcast last week, the One Love Manchester concert was going on. So as soon as we finished it, I put the concert on and was blown away by pop music being amazing, which we will come to in a moment. But then so much stuff has happened since then. It's already ancient history.
Yeah, I kind of can't believe it was only a week ago. It feels like so much has happened in between now and then.
And we've got loads of things to talk about this week, so we're really going to have to jump in pretty quickly. First of all, a minor point of housekeeping. Next week, we're going to survey the contenders for the Song of the Summer 2017. We've had loads of emails with your suggestions already from all corners of the world, but we would like more suggestions, please. Laura, would you like to explain what exactly it is that we're looking for?
Yes. You don't have to back a likely winner. We're not trying to get, you know, it's not like guess the winner and there's some kind of prize afterwards. We just want the song that you think will define this summer for you and the reasons why. And they can be personal or they can be musical, whatever you want. The only rules are that it had to come out in 2017 and it has to be a new song. And you can send these, as ever, to unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com.
Subject header, It's Bad Liar by Selena Gomez.
You can't rig it, Fraser.
Well, it's my podcast. Why can't I rig it?
This week, as we will get onto, the top 10 is incredibly stagnant, as is the rest of the chart. Though there have been some interesting drop-offs. Liar Liar has completely vanished from the top 40 and bombed to number 88, which is pretty miraculous considering the week's political events.
It's almost as if no one wanted to listen to it for pleasure, he yeah. said sardonically.
How many people do you think actually were listening to it when they were racking up the YouTube and Spotify plays or just putting it on and turning the volume right down?
Listening to something much more pleasurable instead. But we have had an email on this very topic from Joel White, and he said, really enjoyed your chat about the truly awful Captain Scar song, and I thought I'd email on this foreboding day. So he emailed on election day to share some thoughts on it. I think the things I find most galling about the song are that, as somebody who sincerely wants to see the Tories out of power for the rest of time, it does such a poor job of communicating the kinds of rage, sadness, and possible redemptive hope that a good protest song can do. But on a more pedantic level, it's also just a complete rerun of a song the same band did in 2010 about the coalition government that year, which was far less viral but basically identical, minus a few pronouns and adapted clunky rhymes. For something so nostalgic to also just be repeating itself every time an opportune moment comes along seems so cynical and sad. Also, I thought it was worth mentioning that while I agree with Laura's comment about lots of young people having skipped the special Scar generation, it's also worth noting that for quite a few, my age, 27, so not that young, Scar and Scar Punk were quite a big thing for a while in the early noughties. British bands like Capdown and King Prawn were a more anarchic, less pop-punk touching stone for a lot of regional scenes around the UK that got quickly tired of the Less Than Jake or NoFX type of Scar pop. Captain Scar tap into all this, but don't even have the decency to put a Scar-based pun in there like everyone used to, like skedaddle or scar tissue or Scarface, etc., etc. That's a great email. Thank you, Joel.
I particularly like the point about the Scar-based pun. But yeah, everything Joel's saying seems completely on the money. I mean, not least because the song has just bottomed out of the charts as quickly as it arrived. It's a shame, really, because for such a momentous occasion, or certainly something that transpired to be such a momentous election, it'd be nice to think that there was like a big proper musical moment that went alongside it. Though, of course, we have not been short of those this week, as we will get onto. So yeah, as we've said, there's not much going on in this week's top 40, but next week's might bring intrigue. The kind of chart battle that I am referring to from now on as the basic Blur versus Oasis, not that that wasn't basic enough to start with. It probably won't have escaped any Unbreak My Chart listeners' notice that on the very day that Katy Perry released her new album Witness, Taylor Swift decided to put all her albums on Spotify after years of withholding them and making some very public statements about why she had done that. Her official line is that it's a gift to her fans after 1989 sold its 10 millionth copy and she achieved the RIAA's 100 million song certification, whatever that may be.
Just to interrupt that train of thought for a second, a gift to her fans who are on Spotify, who were on Spotify when 1984 was released and she took all this of her music off of Spotify, and who now then had to go and get music streaming license from Apple in order to listen to that stuff on streaming services. What fans are there on Spotify that are like, will you please come back onto Spotify, Taylor? I've been waiting for you. Thanks so much.
Can I also say, I was going to say this, that one day we should put out a podcast with our warming up preamble on in the vein of Kermode and Mayo. But Ben, and just now, you referred to 1989 as 1984, which I think is proof of how Taylor Swift's Machiavellian tendencies have kind of infiltrated consciousness. I love the idea that she released an album called 1984.
Genuinely didn't notice it as well. Did it twice. I should really know that stuff.
No, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a proper Freudian slip.
So Witless versus 1984. That's what we're going for in the chart battle.
Yes. That's going to be the title of this week's episode. So, I mean, the obvious implication with this is that it's another shot across the bows in the most out-of-date beef going, which both Taylor and Katie seem pretty keen to keep referencing this week of all weeks. It's almost like it's mutually beneficial or something. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they end up reconciling this in some kind of big, gaudy award show performance at some point in the near future.
Sorry, yes, they're going to do the Piers Morgan thing, aren't they? They're going to apologise to each other in a really, really big way. Mm-hmm. That makes it look like they're super, super big-hearted, the way that Piers Morgan did with Ariana Grande. That's what they're going to do, isn't it?
Yeah, I can see it happening. It's just, yeah, creating beefs in order to quell them again. Yeah, it's absolutely mutually beneficial. It's the girl-on-girl equivalent of Taylor and Harry Styles, where an entire industry, basically, has been spun out of this microscopic moment that may never even have been authentic to start off with, but so much has kind of been born out of it.
And the interesting thing as well, for me, is that Taylor Swift's career exists in two basic places at the same time. There's people that like the music, and there's people that read the gossip pages that suggest that the songs are written about things that have happened in her real life, and therefore they're far more interested in talking about the songs than they are in listening to the songs. And for ages, all of Taylor Swift's songs were supposed to be about her ex-boyfriends, some of whom are famous men. Then she seemed to embrace feminism in a big way. And now all of a sudden, the big topic is more about her beef with women. So it's like, having discovered feminism, Taylor Swift has now moved on to having problems with girls. So it's that weird moment of kind of, you become woke and you become feminist. And then you go, see, now I can definitely say that stuff because it's totally not sexist because I'm a feminist now and I can really attack properly.
Oh, yeah, you can, I don't know, you can, it all seems to be focused like an arrow pointing towards some kind of terrible reconciliation. I was listening to Katy Perry on this radio show thing talk about how when women support other women, like, the world is at peace. She was basically trying to say that, like, women pulling each other down is the only reason that women ever kind of suffer or face any difficulties in this world, which is obviously nonsense. But she's been saying in interviews and on this radio thing that she's ready to pick up the phone to Taylor Swift. She's ready to have a conversation. She keeps saying she loves her and she's ready to move on and blah, blah, blah. And having participated in a huge beef that just pit women against women, and now she's decided that women supporting women is the only way that, you know, women will be saved and exonerated. Now the stage is set for them to do just that and for them to both be like, look, isn't it great when women get along? And I think they're both welcome to each other.
I reviewed Red for BBC Music when that came out, and I noted at the time that there was a definite parallel between Taylor Swift and Morrissey, in that they had rabid fan bases for whom the lyrics were a direct reflection of their own lives and their own emotional landscape. And as time has gone on, that comparison just seems to me, even though it's my comparison, seems to be more and more apposite, because as time goes on, you're starting to realise that perhaps Taylor Swift isn't very nice. And although she appears to be representative of a fan base, more and more what you're hearing about from her is her representing herself. In so whereas for Morrissey, the Smiths songs were about seemingly about a community of people that felt the same way, Morrissey songs are about Morrissey, and I think Taylor Swift has definitely hit the Morrissey stride now, where everything is about Taylor Swift and furthering Taylor Swift's career, whilst also mentioning in passing, hey, we should do feminism now, you should be in my girl gang. And I was saying, this is the other thing that I was talking to you about before we started the podcast, wasn't it? I've always been excluded from Taylor's girl gang, or of Taylor's gangs, because I've never been in the running to be one of her boyfriends, and I've never been in the running to be in the girl gang that she had when she was doing the 1989 tour. So I've always been able to have some sort of critical distance from Taylor Swift because clearly I'm not her sort of people.
Yeah, totally. Whereas I think we would have been, if I had grown up in the same place as Taylor Swift, we would have been in the same year at school. And so it is, I'm looking at her through the lens of being a young woman in who is exactly the same age as her, who purports to stand for similar things, and just looking at her thinking, there's no way that you're still this basic. Like, there's either something willfully naive or calculating going on here. But that brings us nicely to an email that we've been sent by Fiona Stainer, who says that she had been listening to Taylor Swift's catalogue since it went on streaming services. She writes, "It's interesting to me that Taylor has now become the mean girl she sung about throughout her Speak Now album, so much so that if it was released now, you would think she had written it about herself. Since 1989, what with all the Kim, Kanye and Katy stuff, Taylor has pretty much damaged her sweet girl reputation beyond repair. No one is going to believe that shtick if she tries to pull it on the next release. So where does that leave her and her PR machine? Since 1989, we've had Lemonade, a truly game-changing work of black feminism that further exposes the join-the-dots white feminism of Taylor's 1989 incarnation. It also seems fashionable at the moment for pop stars to come across as decent, progressive individuals. What with Katy Perry and her quote-unquote purposeful pop, the chart dominance of Ed and Nice Guy Sheeran, who admittedly probably has a PR machine as ruthless as Taylor's, absolutely, and Harry Styles singing the praises of his young female fans, to name a few examples. And the response to Ariana Grande and her One Love concert shows that too. Pop seems to be in quite a loving, supporting place at the moment. So I guess my question is, will this move and all her moves of the past year or so damage Taylor? Or is she enough of a good pop songwriter that people won't care? Is her next album just going to be her embracing her inner Regina George? I would kind of love that. Fraser, what do you reckon?
I think that's bang on the money. I think everything that Fiona has said about pop music is very true. At the moment, people are looking to pop music to be cross-generational, across gender lines, across sexuality lines, you know, to become the loving global community that politics is so clearly not at the moment. And people are looking to pop music and entertainment to a certain extent to be those things. And for Taylor Swift to position herself as being Cruella de Vil is really interesting, because we've got a Cruella de Vil. She's at number 10 and people really don't like her. And we know this because of the election. What do you think?
When you said we've got a Cruella de Vil at number 10, I was like, but Ed Sheeran's number 10. And then I realised that you meant Theresa May. I mean, it kind of works both ways.
Yeah, I'd love to see Ed Sheeran in a Labrador coat.
On some leopard kitten heels. Fraser, you were talking about how there's kind of like the gossip column version of what Taylor Swift does and then kind of the pure pop version. But I think she's always very cannily intertwined the two. And I think that the only way that she can come back from this is with a full awareness of the way that she's been written about and discussed publicly, as she kind of always has. And just go full Cruella de Vil. Be Madonna at her most imperious, untouchable. Ditch every last drop of that kind of underdog thinking and the like, who, little old me, kind of fakery from her act. I don't, you know, like I say, I'm the same age as her. I'm not like the target kind of teen audience, but I don't need Taylor Swift to be nice. I never expected her to be. It is no surprise to me that the world's biggest pop star is manipulative and conniving. You probably need to be that famous. I just need her to write really, really banging songs. And Fiona makes a point about her peers getting more progressive and what Taylor has to do to follow that. But in truth, I don't really think what Katy Perry or Harry Styles have done with their image is that progressive at all. It's all just good branding geared towards making more money and making themselves look good. And it's built on some pretty shaky politics if you kind of read it properly. I think if anything as well, they're actually following Taylor's feminist awakening kind of lead, which, as Fiona says, all fell apart, not least because she refused to explicitly endorse Hillary Clinton for president. So really, I think all she can do is become an untouchable genius bitch, because any attempt to exonerate herself or suddenly emerge as some kind of political activist will just ring really, really hollow.
You can hear that in Style, because Style is a song about kind of a cold-hearted woman who is flaunting the thing that her boyfriend or the guy that she's got her eye on, the thing that they like, So the list of, you know, the short skirt and the lipstick and all of that that's in that song doesn't feel, when she's singing, it doesn't feel like a sweet come on. It's like she's torturing her, that guy, with the things that she's going to do or going to wear. You know, it's cold hearted and it's provocative. It's always reminded me, Carrie Ad Lloyd had a sketch show that was on the iPlayer for a while. And she has a character which is sort of based on Zooey Deschanel. So it's a manic pixie dream girl caricature. And she just sort of comes into the queue in a cupcake or coffee shop, talks to the sort of hipster type guy in the queue, does all of the manic pixie dream girl trope stuff about how crazy and innovative she is. And now she just thinks about rainbows all the time and all of that. And then at the end, she sort of, just at the point at which the guy is really into her, just goes, "Are you hard yet?" And then looks down at his groin and then sort of kicks her heel up and skips off. And it's that. And it's such a genius observation. Not that I'm saying that all the manic pixie dream girls out there are doing that, but it was just a moment of kind of, yeah, there is a definite real politic to that kind of deliberate, studied vagary that in a personality, that kind of, "Oh, I'm just nice." You're like, no one's just nice. Some, you know, there is definitely a hardcore to everybody. And I think you're right, Taylor Swift were to completely go, all right then, I'm the girl in style, let's take that as the benchmark for the next album and move on from there, it would be really interesting. Time to move on to the top 10, which, as Laura already said, is incredibly stagnant, so we'll not linger too long on too many of the songs. At number 10 is a little known track called Shape of You by Ed Sheeran. I'm in love with your body. I'm in love with your body. I'm in love with your body. Maybe it's finally on its way out. Imagine if it's not in next week.
That would be the first time in Unbreak My Chart history that it's not there.
That would be amazing.
Number 9 is Symphony by Clean Bandit featuring Zara Larsson. I just want to be part of your symphony.
At number 8, There's Nothing Holding Me Back by Shawn Mendes. Oh, I've been shaking, I love it when you go crazy. You take all my inhibitions. Baby, there's nothing holding me back. You take me places that tear up my reputation. Manipulate my decisions. Baby, there's nothing holding me back.
And at number 7 is Slow Hands by Niall Horan, which sounds like this. Yeah, I want you, baby, slow. I don't know about you, Fraser, but I think out of all of the post-One Direction singles, I reckon this is one of the most natural and kind of one of the most likeable for it. It's not something that I would usually listen to, but I find it really appealing. Although it is about having grown-up sex, like a grown-up man, it's not reaching to be sexier than it is, which is something that Zayn can just about pull off for one track at a time, but all the boning on his album gets a bit one note, like, we get it, you really like having sex. And as we've discussed many times, I really love Sign of the Times, but Harry's album has got a very heavy aesthetic and a serious tone that is designed to make you see him in a different light. And you know what I think about Strip That Down by Liam Payne, which I just don't ever need to talk about again. But this is just Niall Horan just being Niall Horan. And although authenticity is really boring and I don't want it from pop stars, I also don't want to see them reaching too hard. If you can see the effort, if you can see the seams and the check marks on a kind of post-boy band demographic checklist, I'm not into it. And I think he's staying in his lane here and it's good for it.
So what you're saying is it's all right to be nice if you are nice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know that much about Niall Horan, but to me he seems like, you know, the little sunshiny one from One Direction. I've never really read anything that nasty about him, though I'm sure now somebody will email us and tell us otherwise. But yeah, he seems like a nice boy, and this is a nice song, and it's not trying to be anything that it's not. But yeah, maybe there is a double standard here, and you've just made me realise that.
I think it's just because he's not massively successful as a solo star yet. And I think the more successful you get, the less likely it is that you're just nice. And the more the sort of machinations behind your success probably become apparent. But there are a lot of nice musicians hire horrible people around them to so that they can continue to be nice while everybody is keeping the stuff that you need horrible people around you at arm's length, because there's a lot of horrible stuff that you have to do if you're enormously famous or that people ask you to do. So yeah, I think this, the only thing I think about this is that it makes One Direction for me suddenly feel like Westlife or Boyzone if this is the solo single. So there's a bit of a Ronan Keating thing about this song. I like it well enough, but what I love about One Direction is that they weren't that. They were very much, you know, they were five boys standing in a line, but they weren't Westlife or Boyzone. And Niall Horan is the closest to being, I mean, if he would have been in Westlife or Boyzone had he been the right age at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, I should clarify, it's not that I think that, you know, I think that probably every member of One Direction is fundamentally evil to a certain extent, and I'm just projecting things onto Niall Horan, but I think I'm just surprised at the fact that I like this song, and I find it routinely in my head despite never putting it on for my, like, for my own pleasure. I might hear it on the radio once a week, but that's it.
So, at number six is Mama by Jonas Blue featuring William... Now, did we work out how to pronounce his surname? Is it Singe?
My brain goes Sange because it wants to read it as the French word for monkey, but I have no idea.
I think it's Singy because he's a singy man.
Number five is Unforgettable by French Montana featuring Swae Lee.
And at number four is Laura's favourite, Strip That Down by Liam Payne featuring Quavo. Party, sipping lightly. When I walk inside the party, girls on me. F1 type Ferrari, six kiss me. Girl, I love it when your body grinds on me. Oh, yeah. Baby, oh. You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down for me, baby. Now there's a lot of people in the crowd, but only you can dance with me. So put your hands on my body and swing that crown for me, baby. You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down.
This is gonna hang around all summer, isn't it? Number three is I'm the One by DJ Khaled featuring Justin Bieber, Quavo, Chance the Rapper, and Lil Wayne. I'm the one.
And number two is One Last Time by Ariana Grande. Ariana Grande's had quite the week, really. The One Love Manchester concert was on Sunday night. It proves beyond all reasonable doubt that pop music is in a remarkable place at the moment and capable of wonderful things. Like, it was absolutely vital that pop music brought everybody together, and it really, watching the concert, I was reminded of so many things that I've been struck by recently. There's a fantastic stand-up show, again on the BBC iPlayer, by Louisa Omilan, which is called What Would Beyonce Do? It's a stand-up show with highs and lows. It's very emotional, but it's also very funny. But what it does really well is put pop music where it should be in relation to the audience watching it. So whenever there are songs referenced within the show, and they're referenced for all sorts of reasons, some of them are heartbreaking, there are moments where she is attempting to get the audience to sing along, and it's always the girls in the audience that are singing along, because these are those songs, you know, the Alanis Morissette You Ought to Know type songs, where, you know, which have been used to help heal betrayal and broken hearts and all that kind of thing. And there are moments in the show that just stop me cold, because they're, you know, everybody is, without being expected to, without knowing that the song was coming up, singing the lyrics back, verse lyrics, not just choruses, at the perfect moment, because they know these songs backwards. And it never fails to make my heart sing when stuff like that happens. And that's what watching the One Love Manchester concert felt like, is everybody was there singing these songs back. You could see the audience of people who were at the original concert. There were probably people that weren't at the original concert, but the same thing was happening. It was like the most glorious coming together of people. You know, obviously voices singing in harmony is a wonderful metaphor for how communities should work anyway, but that was literally what was happening. Whilst at the same time on social media, my friend Rachel was saying that Little Mix were dressed like whores when I thought they were dressed like superheroes. Nobody's looked at pop music like that for years. I was talking to my parents about who Ariana Grande is. So it's that kind of intense spotlight really happened, you know, last Sunday. And so obviously this is why this song has leapt up to number two in the charts. And it was interesting because for me, the song of the night was Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which is, again, as I was saying before, cross-generational. You know, it was a song that was written at the beginning of World War II. And so it was picked up. The forces used it to sort of capture the hope that people in desperate situations would be able to find the resolution that they were looking for. And it's always been used as that down the years. I wrote a piece about it for BBC Music. I really looked into it. And it's why these versions that pop up now and again, such as the one by Eva Cassidy or the one by Israel, and I'm so sorry, I cannot pronounce his surname, but the Hawaiian chap with the ukulele, can pop up and become incredibly meaningful to people because the song is one of those songs about being stuck and then having to try and hope your way out of it. And I know this is just a colossal brain dump about the One Love Manchester concert, but that's exactly how it felt watching it. It was just all this amazing swirling emotions about my pop music and what it was suddenly doing. And I know that you felt exactly the same way, didn't you, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I really loved about it was that Ariana Grande had intended to come out and do a samba set, which I guess was maybe why she had learned Over the Rainbow in the first place. But then she met the mother of Olivia Campbell, who was one of the young victims, who told her that she had to play the hits, like the big raunchy bangers about doing it so much that you can't walk afterwards. Which, I mean, is like, firstly, incredible generosity from that mum, and just testament to how she must have like understood what her daughter got out of Ariana Grande's music, like a lovely, lovely tribute to her daughter. And also, secondly, it's just such a great two fingers to the kind of the terrorists who attacked the concert in the first place, that way of doubling down and wielding pleasure and sexuality so defiantly to a cricket arena full of screaming people.
Absolutely. And there was a lovely thing about who was there, because there is that slight feeling that Manchester was under attack, but also pop music was under attack. But that said, Coldplay, who do straddle the kind of Indian pop worlds remarkably well, were there, and they brought in, you know, there was this feeling that Liam Gallagher was there and he was representing that Mancunian thing, that kind of the Manchester music hierarchy, you know, exceptionally well. But nobody, it wasn't jarring. I mean, the only weird thing that he did was perform his new single, you know, which made it look slightly like a promotional opportunity, but there were artists that were doing things like that. But ultimately, that was what was lovely about it, was you have these moments of Ariana Grande standing next to Chris Martin, who's singing Don't Look Back in Anger, which is a beautiful song for that exact moment. You know, it lyrically, it's so vague, it could mean anything, but that's the beauty of it. It can mean everything at the same time. It's a song that clearly she's never sung before in her life and possibly hasn't even really heard, but she was stood with Chris Martin while he did it, and it was a glorious moment.
When I first saw the lineup for it, I just kind of unimaginatively assumed that each band would do like a five song set or something like that, and then the next one would come on. But the fact that it was a medley and there wasn't any kind of individual focus point, it wasn't Ariana Grande just doing the set that she had done on the Monday of the Attack gig, that everybody was collaborating and doing interesting cover songs and playing together in a really intimate way that you might not have seen before. I just thought it was so immensely tastefully put together. You know, we talk quite a lot on this podcast about how kind of self-serving a lot of collaborations are, and it's all just about you know, getting more hits and jumping on tracks in every single genre possible so that you can dominate streaming markets. But I felt like everything that happened at this concert felt really, really genuine. Even noted dirtbag Justin Bieber coming out and saying a few nice words while playing his song. Actually, the only person who gets minus points is Will.i.am, who kept saying, "Hi, London," instead of Manchester, completely missing the point of the whole thing. How you doing, London?
Do you not even read the news, Will.i.am? That brings us on to this week's number one, which is still Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber. And Laura, you have an excellent fact about Daddy Yankee. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito.
despacito. Quiero desnudarte a besos despacito. Firmo en las paredes de tu laberinto. Y hacer de tu cuerpo todo un manuscrito.
Well, I learned this from Michael Hann, who until recently was the Guardian's music editor of many years standing. He was recently in the south of France at the Midem industry conference, and he went to see Daddy Yankee do a talk about the success of Despacito. And he was asked about the channels that he used to promote his music before he was a big artist. So whether he used streaming or video or social networks. And he interrupted the interviewer to say that Zumba was one of the most important channels that he used. Zumba being the kind of weird choreographed exercise dance that ladies of a certain age do in village halls around the world. He said that's one of his biggest audiences because reggaeton is great for exercising too, so that's what he always bears in mind while making an album, and he thinks that's how he has expanded his audience, which I think is just great.
It's wonderful. It's a whole new demographic that we never even talk about or think about when it comes to pop music, is people that use it to exercise too in these sort of exercise classes. So that's where you have enormously steroidal pumping dance music is useful for step classes or for spin classes or whatever. And yeah, every time you see a Zumba class, they're doing it to reggaeton, which is not a music that necessarily people are listening to in that way that you talk about listening to music. I would also like to throw into the mix samba, because in Truro, where I live, they have the City of Lights Parade, which is a long-standing institution where people are making lamps out of wicker and paper, and they make them into incredibly ornate shapes, dragons and all sorts, and they parade them through the streets of Truro. And there are musicians that accompany the people holding the lanterns. There are a few people playing folk airs and things like that, but they're always followed by samba drumming. Samba drumming is everywhere. And you just think that the cultural crossover between samba and Cornwall is minimal, but the drumming thing is so ubiquitous, and it's in every community, that you can just start this duh, 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 and then everyone's doing it, and it's completely infectious and glorious. And yes, a rainy night in November is not necessarily the best time to have samba, because it's not the same as being in Brazil. It's just interesting that these really utilitarian uses for music are starting to crop up that make people have to listen to music they wouldn't necessarily have been listening to, and that's not reflected in what's being played on the radio or that's in the charts.
So this week's new releases, the top of the list is, though not necessarily for quality reasons, is To You by David Guetta featuring Justin Bieber.
Speak for my heart when it comes to you, comes to you. Want you to share.
Now, it's a challenge, but can we get through this review without mentioning the Chuckle Brothers? Because it's a song called To You, and it's actually it's spelt to the numeral and then U, the capital U. But still, you read that and you go, To You, and you go, well, yes, it's the Chuckle Brothers. So clearly, no, we can't. It's a trap house banger with a dubstep drop, which is just so odd. It's like someone's really followed what's going on in pop music, and then right in the middle, they've decided to throw in a little bit of heavy metal because that's what they really like. The line, no limit in the sky that I won't fly for you, literally makes no sense whatsoever. It's just a whole series of words strung together that sound like you can sort of guess at what they're meaning, but it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Other than that, it's all right, isn't it? I mean, I think there's something in Justin Bieber that he's doing well at making good records, the more people realise that he's not the nicest chap in the whole world, wouldn't you say?
Yep. He is a dirtbag, categorically the world's worst boyfriend, but nothing he can do can diminish that angelic voice that gets me every time. I think David Guetta can diminish the voice. That big dubstepy blurt kind of is ridiculous. This summer is just turning into Dialer Bieber. I don't believe either of them have put any effort into this song. They've made it in about 5 seconds flat. But yeah, before the end of the summer, I predict that we'll see Bieber cropping up with Iron Maiden. Maybe he'll jump on a remix of Liar Liar that will get it to number one. I reckon he's gonna out Sheeran, Ed Sheeran. By the end of the summer, we will have an entire top 10 composed of singles featuring Justin Bieber, a feat that will be even more impressive than Ed Sheeran's album and flooding the top 10 all at once, because it'll be pure organic proof of how popular Justin Bieber is.
It's the ultimate sort of D-bag thing to do, isn't it? It's like, I wasn't even trying. I appeared in these songs and look, they seem to be hits. Oh, wow. I must be amazing.
Everything I touch is a hit. It's such a burden.
Also out this week is Inspired, the second comeback single by Miley Cyrus. And also, it looks like the name of a perfume. It sounds like this.
That sounds so strange, 'cause you've always felt so small, but no, you want it all, and I hope you're feeling inspired.
I kind of like this on first listen, because it sounds a bit like a very youthful Lucinda Williams or something like that, but again, like, it's just reaching so hard. It tries to be this, like, weight of the world song that feels featherlight, and then it quickly turns from saving the planet anxiety to a really bad wheedling ode to her dad just in time for Father's Day. And then on Twitter she was saying that it was for Pride Month, which is a nice intention, but if you read the lyrics, it could just as easily be a Christian rock song, which is kind of the opposite of a Pride celebration song. And she played it at the Ariana Grande show, which feels kind of appropriate in one way when she's talking about how death reminds us of time and what it's worth, and to make the most of it while we're here, as she sings. But also, do you push your new single at a commemorative gig for dead teenagers? I'm not sure. There's something about kind of the angsty purity of her comeback that makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. What do you reckon?
I think her voice is writing depth checks that the song doesn't cash. But also, if you like this sound and this sort of music, you need to check out the first two albums by Martha Wainwright, who is everything that this song claims to be, and a really, really genius songwriter as well. And there are two key songs, and they're on one on each album. There's one, the title of which I can't say because it's all swear words, but it's about her dad, and it's brilliant. It's stunning.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
And then there is the song I Know You're Married But I Have Feelings Too, which is on her second album, which just addresses a topic that's very rare, the topic of potential infidelity or being close to somebody who is in a relationship in an exceptional, mature way, but with all of the yearning and romance of someone talking about an actual romance. That's the basic, for me, that's the level that Miley Cyrus is going to have to reach in order to sell this new pastoral kind of music that she's making.
Actually, that reminds me of one of the great genre switch-ups by a band that I like very much. I credit The Cardigans' Long Gone Before Daylight, which I think came out in about 2002, as being the album that got me into Americana. I think I was probably about 13 at the time, and I'd never really heard music like it before, but I was like, wow, what is this beautiful, burnished, miserable music? And maybe this Miley Cyrus, whatever album this is of hers, might be that gateway for people. So, I mean, like you're saying with the Martha Wainwright thing, anybody who is really getting into this new era of Miley Cyrus, who has not necessarily listened to sad country tinge music anymore, if you want tips, we'll make you a playlist of better songs than these. Uninspired by Miley Cyrus. She's really left an open goal there. So on to our most streamed songs of the week. And I'm sorry to say that I think that Fraser is trolling me with his choice this week.
I am not. It's entirely... I mean, I knew when I picked this that it was going to cause trouble. My most streamed song this week is genuinely 3WW by Alt J, or Al TJ as I've started calling them. And I know that Laura does not like LTJ at all. And I'm not... I think that there's a lot of twaddle that comes in their music. But it's the opening song on their new album. I listened to it on Thursday, which was the election day. And Thursday was a day in which my head was in a bad place. I felt like the world was going to once again kick me in a private area. Because, you know, it's the third big election in 3 years. The results of the first two were not spiffing for me in terms of my own political beliefs. And it felt like everything was consistently getting worse politically. And I wanted something soothing and calming. And I was just doing what I always do, which is just seeing what is out and listening to it and having thoughts. So I put on the Alt J album. Most of the Alt J album for me is utter twaddle. But the first song, this song, 3WW, just managed to calm my collie wobbles. So let's listen to a section of that now, and then I'll tell you what I heard in it in a second.
So much has become a hold of this. All these three words, oh, that we whisper, like the rocking hand.
So for me, this song is a combination of that slow creeping folk thing that's in with a sort of deep bass that's in Teardrop by Massive Attack, or The Kingdom, the 1993 single that Robert Wyatt did with Ultramarine. But it also has what Julian Cope calls the glam descends, which is that running down chord sequence that you also hear in Liability by Lord. But it also has the creeping dread of English folk music in it. It's got elbows, clattery sense of sinuous rhythm, and there's not too much of the usual mannered self-consciousness that I always associate with LTJ, because they're so ruddy clever, but in a really unemotionally involving way. What you're hearing is people tinkering with music, not actually playing music in a way that Talk Talk or These New Puritans or anybody else that's really had a go at fiddling with music always managed to avoid that thing, because it just seemed to be pure emotion using unorthodox tools. Whereas with LTJ, it's unorthodox tools striving towards creating an emotion, I suppose, whereas this ultimately completely calmed me down. And it feels also like the sort of thing that might be on the first album by Simeon, Chemistry Is What We Are from 2001, which is a sodding glorious album. So there's all of that, and I was just as surprised as anyone to discover that I quite like LTJ after just not really getting it for a long time. I never had the hostility that certain people I know had towards them, but I do really, really like this song, and I'm sorry.
I'll say, of all of the LTJ songs that I have listened to, this is definitely one of the sweeter ones. I actually watched a video earlier because I hadn't listened to it before, and as everybody now knows, Fraser hates videos, so I narrated to him what goes on in the video, and I'm delighted to say that it is pretentious nonsense, but quite funny to watch.
Funny to listen to. I imagine it's wonderful.
Just because Fraser was mentioning the election, we had a strange tweet this week from a listener who said that they enjoyed the podcast, which is always really nice to hear, but they objected to something political that Fraser had said on Twitter, and they said that one of the things that they like about Unbreak My Chart is that we do not seem affiliated to one party or another. It's not a political podcast. Now, just, you know, because we hold up pop stars to these standards all the time, just to make it absolutely clear, both Fraser and I absolutely hate the Conservatives and feel quite sick that anybody might even have the faintest trace of doubt that, you know, that might be the case. Just to make that really, really clear, we appreciate that we are reaching people who do not necessarily share the same beliefs as us, but yeah, just for the absence of doubt, that is undoubtedly the case.
And if you want to talk to us about this on Twitter, both of us have reasons to feel personally attacked by the Conservative government. So you're not going to win us round by accusing us of being bleeding heart liberals or anything like that. It is absolutely the case that we are devout taxpayers who definitely enjoy putting money into a communal system and are in utter despair at the way that that money is spent by people with an ideology that is alien to our values.
Yeah, just so we cleared that up. So my most streamed song this week is Did You See by J-Hus, which was in the top 10 briefly, so people may remember it, but in case not, it sounds like this.
Kingsman in like I robbed the nine bar, looking for the baddest diva. Hold up, let me analyze her. Body looking like a hypnotizer. Come let me try some sat you can climb on. Oh, you're a shy one, who you tryna hide from? Baby, jump in a black ride and put your friend in a Wiwa. I'm a pencil addict, pulled up in traffic. Me and my friends switch cars and they look like magic. They've never seen such a skinny man in a big
puffer. I have to say, I didn't really pay a lot of attention to this song when it was in the top 10. I thought it was quite nice, but I let it pass me by. But just this week, I was so sick of all the music that was in my iTunes, and I wanted to listen to something upbeat that was a bit unlike something I might usually put on. So I put on the new J-Hus album, Common Sense, and I really, really loved it. And I reckon Did You See will probably pop up again in our Songs of the Summer list next week, but I love how spare it is. It's lilting and catchy. The processing on his voice gives the rhythm of his lyrics this great little wobble. Also, I saw a lot of Jeremy Corbyn memes about him arriving in a black Benz and leaving in a white one after the success of Thursday Night, so I get some really nice mental images from it. And I reckon, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if this will go back up the charts once it gets properly hot outside. Especially because there's a few songs like this in the top 10, and I think it's much better than all of them.
And that's a perfect place to remind everybody, do email us in your Song of the Summer recommendations, and because this isn't going to be a vote thing, it is literally we want recommendations so that we can just develop an enormous playlist and tell everybody what the proper Unbreak My Chart listeners, who are all people of rare taste and perspicacity, are listening to. And that will be the email at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening and subscribing to the podcast. If possible, and you feel so inclined, please do send us your likes. It just helps us to spread the podcast out to other people. But we're also very, very grateful to everybody who has mentioned the podcast kindly on Twitter or recommended it to friends and any of that stuff, because, you know, the more people that listen to it, the more chance we'll get to keep doing it for longer. So thank you, everybody.
And as ever, you can find us both on Twitter, and you can also share your Songs of the Summer recommendations this way if you don't want to write a long email. I am at Laura Snapes, and Fraser is
at CSI_pop music.
And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.